right. Welcome back, everybody, to the Additive Snack Podcast. I'm your host, Fabian Allerfeld. And today we're diving into a quite intriguing aspect of additive manufacturing, which is its role in the sector of defense. And therefore, joining us today is our special guest, LJ Holmes. LJ is the Executive Director of Advanced Manufacturing Research and Engineering at Harrisburg University. And LJ therefore comes with a very rich background in additive manufacturing, really from its historical roots in the Department of Defense, all the way within its current role in defense and future applications that really underline not only national security, but also reliability. And so today, we'll start by discussing LJ's future and journey from the Army into Harrisburg University, how additive manufacturing has evolved within the defense sector. And we'll also explore some very interesting and undocumented stories of early use cases and current applications within the Department of Defense. So a very interesting episode with a very precise focus. So without any further delay, LJ, welcome to Additive Snack.
Thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be on your podcast. Really appreciate the invite and hope your viewers and listeners enjoy.
I'm sure they will. And yeah, it's worth mentioning this is our second try. First try got disrupted by a snowstorm. So I'm positive that we'll make it through today. And therefore, let's start by talking about you a little bit. How has your journey been within the additive manufacturing space? I understand you started your journey in the Army. How did that go? And how did you end up at Harrisburg University?
All right. Well, my name is Larry Holmes, but everybody calls me LJ. Thank you for the introduction. So I started my career in the Army after working for a few automotive race teams while I was an undergrad. And while I was an undergrad studying aerospace engineering, I was doing some wind tunnel work, making some models. I was making models using composite processing, not 3D printing. But that landed me a job with some race teams working on some composite processing. Mm-hmm. And then the Army Research Lab recruited me out of undergrad because they were looking for somebody that had automotive and composites processing experience. And I guess I fit the bill.
Okay.
Just so the viewers know, the listeners know, that there's a huge difference between paper-thin race composites and foot-thick vehicle armor composites. But there was a lot to learn along the way, so a lot of fun. I started at the Army Research Lab up-armoring lightweight vehicles like Humvees, which were meant to be resupply vehicles, but eventually needed to be up-armored. And that was very rewarding, working on protection systems. And in fact, most of my career at the Army Research Lab, I was able to work in protection system programs, super rewarding. Some of the things that I got to work on, just a little step outside of the 3D printing thing, is think about this. The Army Research Lab mission can sometimes be 45 years in the future.
Wow.
That means that, say, we're working on a personnel protection system, like a bulletproof vest or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. We could be designing technology for a warfighter that's not even born yet, since most of our warfighters are 18 to, you know, in their 20s.
Yeah.
So a 45-year mission means that person that we're trying to save their life is not even born yet. So it's pretty interesting environment to work in. So my background is composites. I consider myself somewhat of a composites expert. And I heard about 3D printing in the early 2000s. I went to my boss and I said, hey, in composites, we have this issue with the XY is very strong and Z not so much. The laminar deformation all the time. And so I went to my boss and I said, hey, there's this thing called 3D printing. Mm-hmm. And turns out you can actually direct and print structure in all three dimensions. We could totally get rid of our issues with Z direction, and it's going to be amazing. We're going to revolutionize composites. So my boss, also being a composites expert, was like, I've heard stuff like this my whole career. Don't get excited. Go do a lit study and let's figure it out. So that was Mick Marr, by the way. Mick Marr, who, after he left the Army Research Lab, became a DARPA program manager. And so I come back to Mick a few months later. I had done a lit review. I had gone to visit some folks who did some 3D printing. And I came back to him and I said, 3D printing is BS, to put it nicely. I said, it has the same issues that we have in composites. There's no Z direction support at all or functionality at all. And unless you want to make bobbleheads, it's useless. However, I see the potential. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, in the long term, there will be huge potential. And I think we can get around some of that Z direction reinforcement issues. And so I said, I think the Army should investigate. Now, the Army has been using 3D printing for rapid prototyping for a very long time, way before I even knew what it was. Kevin Wallace, Rick Moore, Brad Ruprecht, those guys, Lester Hitch, those guys down at Edgewood Chem Bio Center, now DevCom CBC, they're experts, and they've been using 3D printing and additive manufacturing technologies for however many years, long time. And they are experts in making prototypes using commercial off-the-shelf materials and printers. They make training aids and all kinds of stuff for the DoD. Absolutely amazing at what they do. But we hadn't really had any research into 3D printing, at least at the basic academic level for the Army. And the Army Research Lab is considered an academic institute. So I think that first program I was awarded, I think it was just my chain of command just saying they were tired of hearing from me. They were like, and it was $80K for a year, that first program, which I think everyone probably listening knows that you can't really build or design or optimize anything for $80K. You can investigate a technology, how it works, but that's about it, yeah. Right? But we pushed, and eventually about, I don't know, 5 years after that, we had some new management at the Army Research Lab, and our management was very interested to hear from the bench level engineers and scientists about what we thought was important. And so with some colleagues who led the effort, actually, I was just kind of there on the sidelines kind of trying to help push the technology. We were able to convince our director that additive manufacturing was indeed a future thing that we needed to be investigating in. And that led to funding that was allowed me to build the Army's flagship facility for material and process development in additive manufacturing. That's at Aberdeen Proving Ground in Aberdeen, Maryland. Mm-hmm. Still is the flagship for material and process development. So not like what the guys do down at Edgewood. Again, rapid prototyping and probably some of the best in the world. But what we were focused on is understanding the matter-energy interaction, you know, what happens when that laser strikes that powder, or what happens when you overheat your thermoplastic and you end up making a big mess on your FDM head or whatever, yeah. These things that happen. And how do we develop materials that are robust and versatile enough for Army applications? Because, you know, early on, you could get materials that were ABS-like and PLA-like. Well, the DoD doesn't work with like materials, right? We have very stringent requirements, yeah, for what those materials need to do. And so we ended up having to develop some materials that were useful to the Army and creating some new technologies and investigating typical technologies. And it was a lot of fun to have, because I'm a bit of a tinkerer myself, it was a lot of fun to have a additive lab full of equipment had full and open access to all processing parameters, just everything wide open, which means we broke a lot of stuff. But it was very exciting, and my research team now continues to do similar things. So while I was there at the Army Research Lab, I had an opportunity to work with some colleagues across what used to be RDECOM, Research Development Engineering Command. Now it's DevCom. And a couple of my colleagues, Jim Zanino and Dr. Kate Duncan, we created this interagency working group in 3D printing. We started adding some folks from the other research centers in the Army. The ChemBio folks were already doing work in that area, so they joined in. Aviation Missile, Kate was from CERDEC, or now C5ISR, so communications. Jim was from armaments. Mike, Nick Davinsky, and Joe Cott from Tank and Automotive. Lance Hall from Aviation Missile. And this whole group of folks get together, and Stacy Clark-Kerwin, sorry, from our headquarters, get together and create the Army's additive manufacturing community of practice. The history of additive in the Army is a little different than the rest of the services. I think by 2015-ish, not the exact timeline, but somewhere, mm-hmm, in there, mm-hmm, the other services had put a a four-star in charge of additive manufacturing. The Army, much larger than the other services, thought that additive fit in a bunch of different swim lanes, and so didn't put one person in charge, which is accurate because it does fit in a lot of different swim lanes. However, that left the like implementation and burden of implementation early on to us as bench level engineers, researchers trying to push this technology, which ended up being great for all of us because while senior leadership always has the best intentions, they might not always understand the technology, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think we in any situation, not just in mine. And so it was great to not be second guessed yeah. as a bench level engineer and just like, let's keep chugging along. And we ended up creating we created that community of practice. It ended up becoming an official organization within the Army. It's now the Advanced Manufacturing Community of Practice, covering not just additive, but other technology spaces. Okay. And Jim Zanino and Nick Davinsky, who I mentioned, are still leading those efforts for the Army. And they consider me an academic advisor now. And so we were able to decide at the bench level, understanding the technologies, what was important across the board. Now, of course, we didn't implement to 2 million soldiers. I mean, the Army is 2 million people, right? So, or about. But we helped a lot. And I was very fortunate to be involved in that. And I'm excited about it. But it helped me build my network, not just in the Army, but across the services. So that was great. And the other thing that I'm really thankful for there at the Army Research Lab was that I had the opportunity to author the Army's research roadmap through 2045 for additive manufacturing. Wow. And I authored it in 2012, 13-ish. It became real in 2015. So it was a 30-year roadmap for the Army. And it was just an amazing opportunity to have that, to be able to do that with all the input from the community of practice and everyone else. So really building that Army Research Lab roadmap was important to me. And the Army Research Lab still is working through that roadmap. I'm sure they've added and modified and edited, of course. But I'm told by my colleagues that it still lives on. And they continue to try to hit those markers along the way. While I was very, very fortunate to have the opportunity to author that roadmap, it also led to me leaving the Army Research Lab. So that was 2015 when it became real. And over 2015, 2016, 2017, we started working our way up this roadmap. I mean, we were hitting these markers like we expected. Some we had edited, some we adjusted, but we were, really hitting these major hurdles along the way, except for a few. We'd skip a few here and there. And after a couple of years, I went back to look, and everything we were skipping was related to education, workforce development, curriculum development, these things we just kept skipping. And so I had a couple conversations with my chain of command. Again, the Army Research Lab is an academic institute, and they are very, very out front with STEM and outreach activities. And I got to do a lot of that when I was there as well. But my chain of command was just like, well, we can't tell a university how to teach additive. While we can build some training courses for soldiers and Marines, warfighters that want to understand a little bit more, that's fine. But we're not building the industrial base employee pipeline through the Army Research Lab. It's just not their mission. And so that led to me leaving federal service in 2018 to enter the academic environment. I think most of my friends and colleagues around the world, and especially the ones that I've worked with at universities, would not consider me a traditional academic, but I wanted to be able to share my knowledge base and my desire to continue to move additive forward with young scientists and engineers. And to be totally honest, I was getting a little, not burnt out, I was tired of turning a mechanical engineer into an additive engineer and an electrical engineer into an additive engineer. There's already enough red tape in the DOD, as you might imagine, that it makes it very difficult and time consuming and cumbersome. And you end up off schedule and off track sometimes. And so I left Federal Service to go to the University of Delaware to help them build graduate level research capabilities to be able to build a master's and eventually a PhD in manufacturing science. And you know, we're getting there. We're almost there. So I was at the University of Delaware for about 4 years at the Center for Composite Materials. Phenomenal place, excellent research capabilities. The Center for Composite Materials is the center of excellence for composites for the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps, and I think even the Air Force every once in a while. I mean, it's been a center of excellence for like 13 plus years. What they do is amazing, and the team there is awesome. So I was there. They decided composites should incorporate additive. Mm-hmm. Great. And so that's why they brought me in. Worked very heavily with the electrical engineering department there too, because my personal research area is in 3D printed functional devices. We can talk about that in a minute. But we're building this great capability at the University of Delaware, which they still have and still continue to do great work. While I was there, a few of my industry partners, I think Ingersoll, maybe DMG, Stratasys, ABB, a few of them kept asking me about if I knew about Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. And I had never heard of Harrisburg University, and neither had you before we had started this conversation, right? So, and apparently Harrisburg University had started this undergraduate program in advanced manufacturing, and I heard about it. I looked into it, looked very exciting, all hands-on kind of ideas. And I was thinking, man, that's what I want. I want hands-on capable students to enter this graduate program we're building at University of Delaware. And so I reached out to schedule a meeting. I came out to Harrisburg to talk with them about, you know, maybe the students from the undergraduate program at Harrisburg University be a pipeline to the graduate program we eventually want to have at the University of Delaware. And that meeting turned into a job opportunity, and I decided to jump at it for several reasons. And so when I first came here, I think people thought I had fallen off the map or kind of retired or something. I'm like, why is LJ going to this little school? I'm going to tell you why. Because it's amazing, because it's non-traditional, and because it's very forward-leaning. So Harrisburg University of Science and Technology incorporated, I think, or organized, maybe better word, in 2001, first students in 2005. So we're just under or just over 20 years, depending on how you look at it. 20 years old for a university is very young. Harrisburg University's number one priority is to graduate students debt-free. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We do that by leveraging our graduate and professional development programs to almost fully subsidize our undergraduate programs. And we're not perfect, but think about it this way. I'll describe our advanced manufacturing curriculum, but we have students that go to school for less than $5,000 a year, some $1,000 to $2,000 a year, which is amazing and totally different from the typical university in the U.S.
Yeah.
Couple other bragging points. I'm a father of two teenage daughters, so my favorite one is that we're 45% female in undergrad and 51% female in grad as a STEM school. I don't know what the national average is, but I think that we're doing pretty well.
It's definitely higher.
And I've asked our recruiting folks, people ask me all the time, how do we do that? And I've asked our recruiting folks, like, how do we do that? And they say there's no secret. It's that we offer hands-on access to STEM technologies instead of just promising that you'll learn theory. And then if you go to grad school, you might touch a machine. Everybody gets involved from day one, freshman. And so that apparently has been very appealing to female students who want to get into STEM. And we're happy to do it. Love it. So we started the advanced manufacturing program started before I got here. Of course, they started about 6 years ago now. So we're going to graduate our third class in May. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a third class of graduates. So still a new program, still learning and building. My predecessor, Dr. Chip Shriru, unfortunately passed away of COVID during COVID, but he was building an amazing program. And I'm happy to jump in and kind of continue with my partnerships and the people that I work with on the research side. On the curriculum side, my colleague, Dr. Richard Pitts, is the program lead for the Advanced Manufacturing Undergraduate Program. He's a phenomenal leader in curriculum and academia, and a true academic as opposed to me. So we've built some amazing capabilities in advanced manufacturing. I see a lot of programs that call themselves advanced manufacturing, actually a lot at the high school level. I've been looking around. I visited a tech high school recently that has an advanced manufacturing program. I went to see it. It was machining, which is important and also part of our program, but that's not all advanced manufacturing, right? And so I asked the lead there why they called it advanced manufacturing. And he said, to be honest, it was just the buzzword. So we picked it up so students would get interested. And I'm like, well, that's great for you, but do you know that hurts us in, you know, secondary and at college and universities when you call it something that it's not?
Yeah.
So anyway, but we consider advanced manufacturing to be the advancement of either materials and processes in manufacturing. So creating new materials, creating new processes, or using traditional materials or traditional processes in a different way, and just continuing to evolve manufacturing. So just a little bit of info about our program, because I think it's amazing too. And then we'll jump back to the DoD. So our students in the advanced manufacturing program, we have one classroom. It's typically used for meeting or material discussion. Everything else is taught in the lab. It's all hands-on. When I took engineering undergraduate courses, I took classes 2 to 3 days a week, separate lab. That lab was typically taught by a student or a TA or a lab instructor or something along those lines. And rarely did that lab activity ever really align with the syllabus of the class. And I've seen that in not just my undergrad, many other undergraduate engineering programs across the U.S. And we get rid of all of that issue by teaching theory and practice in front of the equipment. And so by the time our students graduate, we expect them to know 2 to 3 robotic processing languages, 2 CAM packages, 2 CAD packages, and be expert operators in autonomous systems, robots, 3D printing, machining, welding, whatever it may be. So that's our program, and it's amazing. And I love that the university is small. It's very lean at the top, no red tape. I think my nickname at the Army Research Lab was Loophole. I haven't had to use that nickname here at all. They're really pretty excited to get ready and go do some things. So please look up the website jdammit.com, jdammit.com. Last year, we held a conference for advanced manufacturing in September. It's defense focused. That's JDAMMIT's Joint Defense Advanced Manufacturing Meeting for Innovation and Transition. And it's really about how are we using these technologies and how have they been transitioned to the DoD, or how are they currently being researched to be transitioned to the DoD. And it's all hands on. It's a 3-day, there's a keynote kind of thing in the morning. And then the rest of the time you spend in the lab is elbows deep, hands on as you want. And we had some wonderful people from EOS with us last year displaying our P110 and allowing attendees to learn how to change out material, break out a build. We get everybody gowned up, full PPE. You want to touch, taste, smell, whatever it is, get involved in advanced manufacturing. This is the way to do it. Okay, so enough, I think, about Harrisburg University. We should talk a little bit about the DoD.
Yeah. This was a lot to unpack, but this was, I did not know how instrumental you were in the Army and building the additive manufacturing roadmap. I think that's super interesting, right? And it's interesting to really understand that you came from composites. You really built that additive manufacturing strategy for the Army, and now you're building the workforce of the future, really, for not only the Army but for the industry. If you think about it, a natural progression, and you're really making sure that the pipeline of talent is filled, right? I mean, when I went to college, yes, we had labs, like you said, but those were the exciting classes, not the theory. Yeah. So it's really interesting to see that you guys solely focus or mainly focus on hands-on activities. And we should actually talk offline on how we can support that even more.
Sounds great.
In the industry.
I will say that all of our student projects are partner driven. So whether they be our industry partners or our government partners, our students have to do two projects in their undergraduate curriculum. Some universities might call them cornerstone and capstone. We call them just project one and two. Project one happens freshman to junior year, and project two is the senior project. But every student gets to pick the type of work that they want to, the type of project they want to work on. And then we try to align them with an industry partner or government partner. And that works about 99% of the time. There's one or two in there that we have to figure out. But for the most part, our industry partners have just been phenomenal at allowing us to allowing our students to work on their problems and try to solve some things. These are, you know, 18 to 22 year olds that are working hard in the lab to try to solve an industry level problem. And that's great. I love that.
Yeah. So since you did play such an instrumental role in the strategic roadmap of the Army and still play a role through, you know, what you just described, also through conferences and the talent that you place into the industry, what are some of the use cases now that the Army or in general the Department of Defense is leveraging additive manufacturing for? Where do we see true impact of advanced manufacturing specifically to additive now?
You led your listeners into maybe hearing some off the books stories. Yeah. I'm going to tell you one off the book story that may or may not be true and is not documented. So this could be just LJ story time. Okay. In the late 90s, early 2000s, there was some DED type technologies being developed, a lot of which were funded out of DARPA programs. One of those ended up at an Army depot. And that Army depot was in charge of fixing tanks that were coming back for repair. And the guys there at the shop, they're typically welders and machinists, kind of grasped on that, to that technology when it got into their space, their labs, their workspace on an assembly line. It seems kind of weird for maybe a DED-like device to be on an assembly line at an Army depot. In that time period, right? In their late 90s, early 2000s. Anyway, they embraced the technology early on. And it turns out that there were several times where that group was working on engines that were jet engine style engines. And they have, you know, turbine blades inside of them that were being worn or broken. And they used this technology to fix those parts or recreate those parts and signed off as the program engineer on the assembly line, signed off as a modified welding technique because DED is a modified welding technique, right? Yeah. And so in this magical, fantastical, fictional description that I just laid out, which is obviously not real or documented, there would have been many additively manufactured or additively repaired parts that have been on operating military vehicles since the early 2000s without being documented as additive, modified welding technique. And so then you get to the point where our bureaucratic system takes control, which there's a lot of benefits to. One of the cons is that it slows things down and may provide a lot of red tape and may need to also instill some certification and qualification or some requirements that could continue to slow things down. So I don't know how many critical, flight critical or propulsion critical components have been additively manufactured and put into current military vehicles. But in this hypothetical that I've laid out, the Army has had them in vehicles since the early 2000s.
Wow. That might be the earliest use case of blade repairs of the industry that nobody potentially knows about.
Nobody knows about it. Yeah. It's awesome. And of course, if there were people that were doing this at some Army depot, they have since retired and those stories are long forgotten.
Yeah. Man, that's interesting. Thank you for sharing this hypothetical story.
It's a lot of fun. But let me share a little bit about some of the things that are going on in the DoD that I see. And I know we've been recording for quite some time. So I'm going to focus on a couple things. I gave an interview at MIL-AM last year with Melanie Lang, and I talked about how I saw the industry going toward the extremes. And by that, I mean very big and very small. I think those things are still happening. The very small things, it's super interesting. And what types of physics problems we can attack on the light spectrum scale that we can now attack with very precise nano to micro size additive manufacturing. That's amazing stuff. I think there's huge upside to that in the future. But then on the total other end of the spectrum, there's large scale machines. And I've been very fortunate to be able to work on the world's largest hybrid manufacturing system called the jointless hull. And I've got a picture I'll show you guys in a little bit. But the idea behind jointless hull is that since Vietnam, the vast majority, I think in the upper 70s, vast majority of vehicle losses have been due to underbody blast or roadside bombs, that sort of thing. And the failure mechanism or the failure location is often, if not 100%, the weld or joint in the hull of the vehicle. Okay. And so the jointless hull project, the idea came from a conversation between myself and Joe Cott, who's now with Futures Command, Army Futures Command. He was with Tank and Auto and Ground Vehicle System Center. Anyway, we talked about this. How do we get around it? It seems like additive would be the right idea, but how do we get around these issues? And we said, well, what if we print the whole thing? At least the structure. Maybe we're not printing the electronics, maybe we're not printing the tracks or the tires, but let's print the structure of the vehicle, at least so there's no welds or joints. Or you could look at it and say it's all welds or joints, but I think it's better to say there's no welds or joints, a monolithic structure. That's what we're going after. So the project's called Jointless Hull. We POM for it, which means we got it put into our mission portfolios, both from the Army research side and the ground vehicle side back in like 2017 before I left federal service, maybe 2016. But it was too big of a problem for one research unit to attack. And so after I left federal service, I joined some colleagues at Astro America, the Applied Science and Technology Research Organization of America, which is like this think tank and research institute that also executes congressional interest projects. And we were able to go get the Jointless Hull project funded through Congress. Representatives Bustos and Durbin from Illinois were very supportive. And so that program resulted in two machines. So the Jointless Hull program is not just one machine, it's two. There's a smaller system, we call it subsection tool. It's at the Army Ground Vehicle System Center in Detroit. And it's got a build volume of like, I think like meter. I think it's actually like 3 feet, 4 feet, 5 feet, something like that. Pretty big. That's pretty big build volume in and of itself. However, the jointless hull machine at Rock Island Arsenal, which is where the Army's Advanced Manufacturing Center of Excellence resides, has a build volume of 30 feet by 20 feet by 12 feet. And so this massive capability and lots of thought went behind this. Like there are naysayers that ask me all the time, why did you build something so big? And the technology is not, maybe not be ready, but I disagree. I think the technology is ready. And if you have the right partners, you can make things happen. In this case, the implementation team, the prime contractor was Ingersoll Machine Tool, and they worked with Meld and Siemens Digital Industries to manufacture this large machine and did a phenomenal job. And so we've been working on it for several years now. The machine is installed at Rock Island Arsenal, and we've been printing some sample parts lately. And I think next month we actually are going to print our first very, very large, very long, multi-day print. I'm very excited about that.
Wow. That's cool.
I think in this case, a lot of people ask about the technology. And so I want to address it here, as I do whenever anybody asks me why friction stir additive. They normally say why melt, but they're really asking why the technology friction stir additive. And we did a huge investigation of all the metal AM capabilities around the globe and in the US especially. and invited all of those organizations that we thought might have a chance at being able to build this large thing, and many of which just said, we're not ready, which is great. I love that they were honest and forward about that. But when we looked at the technology space, Ingersoll also, you know, looked at this as the lead of that team and partnering with Meld. When you look at this technology space, we knew that we were going to want to add and subtract, right? It's a hybrid machine. We're not going to get the full functionality, full design capabilities out of just an additive machine. And so we knew that we needed subtractive in there as well. And there's no way we're going to print something the size of a tank and then put it in an oven and then put it back in the machine to machine it down to tolerance, right? That's not going to happen. And you wouldn't be able to create any internal structure either. So FrictionStir Additive offers the largest library of materials that can be directly deposited and then subtracted immediately without going through a heat treat cycle. It is.
You have no stresses, really.
No means is it perfect. And some of the materials that you might use definitely needs heat treatment, but some don't. And FrictionStir offers probably the largest library of those materials that don't need that heat treat cycle in between. Now, if your material is structurally sound enough that you can deposit and machine and create the large structure and then put it in an oven, that's even better, right? So I'll show that machine here in a minute. I know we're running through some time. I think the other thing that's super interesting to me that relates to some of that small scale stuff is multi-material processing. Mm-hmm. While the jointless hull tool is hybrid, it does two things, right? It does some additive and a subtractive technology. But my personal research space and what I find so amazing going on in the DoD is printed functional devices. Mm-hmm. And I'll show you a couple examples here in a second. But think about your phone. It's a rigid rectangle. And so is your laptop. And so is your monitor. And Fabian, why do you think those things are all rigid rectangles?
Because of the silicone, right?
Yeah, because the circuit boards inside are all, what they're made of, are all rigid rectangles, yeah. Right? But if we could 3D print those electronics, then perhaps we could create some things that were more, not just functional, but ergonomic. Is this ergonomic? I mean, my kids drop these things all the time.
Right? I do every day.
Exactly. Right. So is it the proper design for a phone? I don't know. I'm not a phone designer, but I know that if I could offer the world the opportunity to be able to print in three dimensionals, electronics, functional devices, that we might open up design space, might open up design freedom. And that's been the additive motto for quite some time right now. So we're just throwing in electronics. I'll show you a couple examples real quick. I know we're running.
No, you're good. Soon. You're good.
So Cyperio is a research organization who is the parent company for Nscript. Your viewers or listeners might recognize Nscript as an additive manufacturing OEM out of Orlando, Florida. And again, Cyperio, the parent company, is a research arm as well. I've worked with them for many years. And here you see some examples of 3D printed functional devices. In this case, these are 40 millimeter rounds. Now, these are non-lethal 40 millimeter grenades. Here's also another non-lethal one, but you get the idea in my hand. This is what a 40 millimeter grenade round looks like, about the size. We're obviously adding some electronic components here to these that can be shot down range for many applications. Some of the ones that you see here have different sensors that I won't talk about exactly, but you might imagine maybe antennas and transmission devices that could create a network repeater, right? So if you're in an area where you don't have network or the network's denied, you can maybe shoot one of these down range to continue increasing your network capability, right? So very, very important. Here's another example from when I was at the University of Delaware. Some colleagues and friends of mine created a spinoff company called Deluxe Advanced Manufacturing, and I was fortunate enough to be part of that organization as well. But was recently purchased by Samtec, and So the folks that were at Deluxe are now with Samtech, and at Samtech did really well by getting those folks. But here's another example. So this was, again, made for a 40 millimeter round, but this is just the nose cone kind of thing. And here you see, again, you can see the CAD there, a very complex CAD of a functional device with electronic components built inside of it. This one is a chemical sensor. So the idea here is a soldier or warfighter sees a cloud of gas or something downrange. They don't know what it is. Could it be dangerous? Just shoot one of these downrange. The sensors inside this package can evaluate what that cloud is and send that information back to the user. And of course, you know, that it could be, oh, it's just dust, it's fine. Or it could be chlorine gas or something. You probably don't want to go that way. And so, you know, safety features built into to new capabilities provided solely because we can 3D print electronics in three dimensions and be able to package them differently than traditional packaging.
Yeah, and these have even, you know, not only defense application, but natural disaster applications, right? I mean, that's you're shooting right. A router into a location where there's no signal, or a disaster like we had in the States months ago with a train, right? You don't want to get too close, but what's the chemical composition of the leak? Yeah, that's interesting. Wow.
You're exactly right. So very exciting things there. And I think one of the things that you mentioned also excites me a lot is about expeditionary manufacturing, which has military uses, but also has civilian uses, especially for disaster relief. And while I didn't focus on it with some slides and we didn't talk about it a lot, I think you'll see, you're seeing now at I think, Defense Manufacturing Conference, MIL-AM, Rapid, and even AMUG over the last couple of years have been talks about putting additive manufacturing into shipping containers and sending them around the globe to be able to do things. And that's useful for both industry and defense. So I think you're going to see a lot more of that over the next few years. I'm very excited about it. I feel like I know some secrets that I'm not going to share.
Hypothetically, you could share them.
Okay. So enough lead up. Here it is. Here's the big machine. Wow. And so AMUG's coming up here pretty soon, right, in March. So I'm going to moderate a panel to talk about this technology. But the panelists are going to include folks from CorVid, General Dynamics Land Systems, and Boeing. And so users in the defense and industrial community that want to be able to print large things and have never had access to it until now. And they're going to talk about how this fits into their company's roadmaps and how it changes their supply chain issues that everybody seems to be running into, and just novel capabilities and novel design space that they hadn't really thought that are expected to be able to have access to. And so the picture on the right was an Army released photo of the jointless hull tool during its final assembly while it was at the Ingersoll plant. And so you can see it's kind of bolted to the floor there, but it's actually on the left where it is now at the Rock Island Arsenal. It's an extra like 3 feet taller on that concrete pad. The machine itself approaches 50 feet. So it's a 5-story building. That picture on the left, I'm standing about 20, 25 feet in front of it. And it is just massive.
Is this the largest additive system?
It's the largest hybrid system for sure. Okay. There are additive systems that I think could
maybe relativity match space the size could be, dimensions. Yeah.
Those additive systems are also on rails, like this one. And some of them are robotic controlled robots on rails. And so if you think about it, you just add longer rails. You can say I've made a bigger machine every time I make a longer rail, right? I mean, this one's on rails too. So I think somebody dubbed it the world's largest metal additive machine. I will say that I believe it's the world's largest hybrid machine.
Okay. And just to, for the listener, so it's a 50 feet.
It's about 50 feet tall, the machine itself.
System. And what's the build envelope, roughly?
30 feet by 20 feet by 12 feet.
Okay, and that's a friction stir hybrid machining system.
You got it.
Okay.
So Meld provides the friction stir capabilities, and Ingersoll's machining provides the machining capabilities. However, we did design this to be tool changing because we believe, well, I mentioned the reason why friction stir was so important and Meld was the technology that made it capable of working on this machine. We think that there are other technologies that could be useful as well. So this is tool changing. In the future, we might add some other technologies. I think there are a lot of folks that are high on some wire fed systems right now. Since this is it's obviously an open air, right? It's in a giant facility, but it's open air. So not likely to go directly to powder yet, but maybe in the future. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I see some wire capabilities, or maybe even I'm very excited to work on some recycling capabilities with Meld and with other companies about because theoretically, friction stir could process metal chip, like from machining processes. So that would be interesting, right? I mean, you could add many different feedstocks at many different scales there.
Yeah.
So yeah, there she is. Lots of fun.
Yeah, man, you probably have one of the most diverse jobs in the additive manufacturing industry, huh? From education all the way to these massive research projects that build the largest hybrid metal printer in the world.
I'm very, very fortunate. Very fortunate to just to be able to work on some cool stuff.
Well, LJ, hey, this was a very, very insightful conversation to me. You know, before we jumped into this episode, my main perspective or perception was that the Army especially mainly leverages additive manufacturing for supply chain reasons, maybe printing a spare part here and there to keep some vehicles afloat. But I think you've really showed us that the innovation approach and the performance aspects of additive manufacturing really take a larger role in the Army's roadmap for additive than the supply chain angle does. Is that a correct point of view that I'm showing here right now?
Absolutely. Absolutely, you're 100% accurate. And I don't just see that, and that's a recent change, actually. I mean, recent by within the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. But I think you pay attention to the way the government, the U.S. government itself is supporting supply chain changes and supply chain advancements through additive and other manufacturing technologies. Another shout out to my friends at Astro America. For your listeners to go check out AM Forward. AM Forward is a project that's out of the White House, and Astro America's managing that program under the leadership of Neil Orringer. And that program has the potential to affect hundreds, if not 10,000 small to medium sized enterprises in the United States that are small suppliers to these larger organizations that build and deliver things to the U.S. government. So check out AM Forward.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll throw those links that you mentioned throughout this episode into the show notes as well, so people have easy access
thank you so much. That's great.
To the websites. Well, LJ, I know you also got a run, and I really appreciate your time today. So thanks for sharing all the documented and undocumented stories with us today. It was really...
Hypothetical,
yeah, stories. It was a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Okay. And
if I didn't, friends that are out there that I didn't give a shout out to, I'm sorry. Next time.
We'll have you back once you build the next largest XY system whatever it may be.
Challenge
accepted. And to our listeners out there, also thanks for listening. As I mentioned, we'll throw all the interesting links that LJ mentioned today into the show notes. Check it out. Whether you are just entering the industry and are also looking for some educational resources, or are trying to understand better what the Department of Defense is really doing in the additive manufacturing space, I think, and I hope that this episode really gave you a better understanding of what's going on. At least it did it for me 100%. So yeah, help us to share this episode, like it, share it, to help us expand the additive manufacturing industry and out of just our little circle that we sometimes communicate in. And This was Additive Snack. My name is Fabian Allerfeld, and I'll see you next time.